Even if you only have a small patch of garden space or maybe even just room for a few pots on a patio or balcony, I'm betting most of you plant some veggies every year. It can be really satisfying to plant seeds or plants and tend to them. And if you end up with some succulent tomatoes or delicious salad greens, all the better. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Hendrickson is with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He's the outreach specialist for fresh market vegetables and food systems and is also the coordinator of the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. John, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
And we have lots to talk about. John's happy to answer your questions about growing great veggies. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or a comment or a great photo of your veggies on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Sometimes Larry forgets that not everyone knows how to spell that, so it's good to let people know how to find it. And Rhonda Fanning, our on-air producer today, will be happy to get your calls and emails to us. So, John, now that we're well into winter, spring and summer gardening seem a long way off, but dreaming about them can help us get through those long winter days and nights. What are some of your favorite vegetable varieties to grow yourself?
Well, first of all, this is actually kind of my favorite part time of the year in terms of gardening.
Why?
Because right now everything's perfect.
There you go. Nothing.
Because your garden exists in your mind and your dreams, and everything's perfect. You've gotten everything. You're going to plant everything on time, and everything's going to get well watered.
You're going to keep track of where you planted it.
Yeah, everything's going to be just. It's just ideal.
And you're going to mulch.
Actually, the planning part is actually something I really enjoy doing. And I think it's actually something that's really critical in order to have success, is to have a well-organized, well-planned, whether it's just your home garden or certainly if you're doing this as a commercial business, you really need to have a very detailed and relatively sophisticated plan in order to do this.
And so what are some of your favorites when you're dreaming of that next season? What do you think? Oh, I can't wait till that comes up, or I can't wait to get seeds for this and try it for the first time. Or
yeah, well, you know, one of my favorite crops is carrots. So we're still actually enjoying carrots from last year's crop and from our cooler. But of course, the things that I maybe think of most are the things that I don't have access to right now. I love a crisp, fresh cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh salad greens are something that I really miss right now. My household uses a lot of cilantro, and my spouse wishes I could come up with a way to grow it in the snow
cilantro's tricky, can be tricky anytime, so it's definitely not something that's easy to keep going too long.
Well, it's one of those things you kind of have to keep replanting
right.
over and over and over again because it bolts and goes to seed so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to grow small amounts of it over and over again.
So let's go back to your carrots, for instance. Do you tend to try new heirloom varieties that are available for different flavors and colors and shapes? Or do you have some tried and true carrots that you go back to every year?
I would say a little of both. I do have my favorites. I grow a lot of carrots that I harvest as baby carrots that I, on my farm, I sell to restaurants. But there's always new varieties to try in the catalogs. And one that I tried relatively recently and really enjoyed is a variety called Hercules. And it's called Hercules because it has these big, broad shoulders and then
so
tapers
it looks like,
down.
It doesn't make you Hercules. It looks like Hercules. That's too bad.
And I think it's not a real popular carrot yet in terms of other market farms, but I've done some taste tests with it, and the taste is absolutely fabulous.
Now, for someone that might be getting started even just as a home gardener, maybe it's the first time that they've had a little spot that they can plan for a vegetable garden, how do you choose the right seeds or the right plants, depending on what you're planting? How do you know what might work for you or what you might enjoy?
Well, I would say the first thing to do is to ask friends and neighbors for
who have similar growing conditions.
Right. That would be the place I'd first try. It's a little bit, it's a slippery slope to just opening up the seed catalogs, because a seed catalog, you know, every tomato variety, they make it sound like it's the absolute best tomato that you're ever going to grow and you're ever going to eat. And obviously, you have to make some choices. Right. You can't grow every single tomato variety. Otherwise, you're going to fill up your whole garden.
Also going to use probably two seeds from every pack if you're trying to grow 100 different
kinds. Right. Not very economical to order all those different tomato varieties. So, you know, there's some, I guess, some tricks that you can decipher from the seed catalog. If a tomato is described as, you know, as a good shipper, if you're looking at a commercial seed catalog, you know, that usually means it's going to have a tougher, you know, skin, maybe isn't going to be as flavorful. Other things that I like to look for is disease resistance when I'm picking a tomato variety. And then, of course, with tomatoes, one, you know, really important consideration is to, you know, understand the difference between indeterminate and determinate varieties. The two determinants are being shorter and less viney, and they're going to produce most of their tomatoes in a shorter window of times compared to an indeterminate, which is going to keep producing that long vine and produce tomatoes over a longer period.
With the indeterminants, does it matter? Does it affect their production if you stake them so you're not having tomatoes trailing all over the place?
It's still very useful to cage or stake a tomato to keep it up off the ground. You know, most of the plant diseases that affect tomatoes are soil-borne diseases, so keeping that plant up off the ground is definitely...
And maybe making it just slightly harder for the chipmunks to get it.
That
slightly.
Too.
Not that too. Really works, but...
And those darn rodents seem to want to take one bite out of every fruit as opposed to just sticking with one.
I know. I wish they would just stake their claim on one tomato and leave the rest. But no, they have to taste every one. So you talked about how important this time of year is for planning for your garden. What are some of the things to take into consideration as you're planning?
Well, you need to think about how much space you have and how you're going to utilize and maximize that space in most cases, especially for a home gardener with limited space or maybe just a patio. And so it's a matter of prioritizing, you know, which crops you, A, maybe really enjoy eating or really enjoy growing if you have limited space, or, you know, maybe it's an economic decision. I know I can get, you know, zucchinis cheap.
Yeah, probably
elsewhere.
Free. Yeah.
And so utilizing your space for your favorites. Mm-hmm. And things that grow well for you.
And also thinking of, I mean, we don't have a very long growing season in Wisconsin, and certainly parts of the state as you go farther north have even shorter growing seasons. But that doesn't mean that there aren't kind of stages that you can grow things in, too. So what are some of the early season vegetables that you might be able to grow and then actually use that space for something else?
That's a really great point. I think especially many beginning gardeners kind of make the mistake that, you know, there's one weekend in the year when you plant your garden. And then the planting part is done. And then you just proceed to all the other stuff, weeding and harvesting and enjoying.
Right.
But in reality, planting needs to, you know, should be happening multiple times through the year. In the early season, you can get started with peas and spinach and radishes and things like that, things that like a cool season. Lettuce, planting an early crop of broccoli in the spring. And then there's other things that you're going to have to wait a little bit and not jump the gun on unless you have a way to protect the more sensitive crops from those late frosts that we sometimes get. Things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and zucchinis and squashes and melons and things would be planted later. And then one thing that I think a lot of growers don't realize is how wonderful the fall garden can be in terms of planting things to be harvested in September and maybe even into October.
And what are some
broccoli,
of those?
Broccoli, a fall crop of carrots. You can get a spring crop of carrots planted early, and then you can plant in the middle of July, at least in southern Wisconsin, plant in the middle of July and have an excellent crop of carrots. In the, you know, carrots are a cool season crop, and they are sweeter and taste better in the cool season. So it's actually better. The fall crop is actually in some ways much better than the spring planted crop, where it might be starting to get a little bit too warm in July by the time you harvest those carrots.
And so when we're talking about things to harvest in the fall, when would those items be planted usually? Is that July, August?
Well, it depends. I mentioned the carrots would be planted in July. Fall planted broccoli and cauliflower about that same time. Other things that don't require as much time, such as lettuce and radishes and things like that, baby turnips, they can be planted, you know, just several weeks before, you know, in the case of radishes, several weeks before you might want to harvest them in the fall.
Great. And we touched on it earlier when you were talking about cilantro and that you really need to keep seeding to have a continual source of that because they do tend to bolt. What are some other vegetables or herbs that we could benefit from planting more than once through the season? You were talking about, you know, one in the spring, one in the fall, but some things we should actually be planting every week or so.
Yeah, the salad greens is probably the biggest group of crops in that category. The lettuces and all the Asian greens that you can mix into your salad, those things can be planted every several weeks. The radishes that I mentioned, turnips, those are all things. Basically, the things that are take a very short amount of time to grow mm-hmm. are things that you can plant every 2 to 3 weeks through the growing season and enjoy them all season long.
What about beans?
Beans are another crop that you can get several crops of. Many fresh market vegetable farms will plant 3 plantings of beans or maybe even more through the growing season to get multiple pickings. And you know, the other one is zucchini. That's one that you know usually succumbs to pests and disease. And so if you have a second planting, you can continue to enjoy that if you want to continue to enjoy that. After getting tired of them.
But, you know, there are a lot of things that you can do with a zucchini when you're faced with a big pile of them.
Well, and zucchini bread is, you know, you can make a ton of it and freeze it. It's a great thing to keep mm-hmm. in your freezer.
Well, so we're just talking about beans, and Brian had a question on our Facebook page. How well do fava beans do in Wisconsin? He says he was wondering because he never sees anyone growing them here at all. He lives in Schofield.
Well, fava beans is one that I have not grown, so I don't have any direct experience with that. And it is a crop that is going to require warmer temperatures and a longer growing season. So it might be one, you know, beans are something that no one really thinks about transplanting. It's something that's routinely direct seeded. But if you really were crazy about fava beans, my recommendation would be to try to transplant them to get a jump and extend that season in order to give them a chance.
Right? Nothing to lose but a few seeds. We're talking with John Hendrickson today on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. John is with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He's the Outreach Specialist for Fresh Market Vegetables and Food Systems and is also the coordinator of the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. We'll share information about that training opportunity, and John is happy to answer your questions about growing great veggies, whether you're planning on selling them or just enjoying them for yourselves and your family. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Talking about growing great garden veggies with John Hendrickson, and we will go to the phones in just a minute. But John made good use of our little break there and found some information about fava beans. And John, what did you find out?
Well, I'm looking at a seed catalog that shows a variety of fava bean that is a 75-day crop in terms of from seed to harvest. Green beans are typically 50 to 60 mm-hmm. days, so it's not too much longer. So certainly seems like something that could be done.
All right. So
you want to get them started as early as you can.
All right. So, Brian, your job is to grow some fava beans and then report back to us at the end of the growing season. Well, we do have some folks on the line who'd like to talk with you. So let's start with Jerry in Spooner. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I grow 6 or 8 different kinds of salad greens, and I'd like something that's more crispy. I always have a wilted problem once I put the salad dressing on it.
So a crisp kind of head or leaf lettuce, either one?
Well, I don't want head, I guess. It probably takes more time.
All right. John, what do you think?
Yeah, the lettuce varieties that typically have a bit more crunch, there's different names for them. The Batavian types and butter crunch varieties will give you that. Another thing that you may want to also pay attention to is the time of day that you're harvesting. And also make sure to cool those salad greens down as quickly as possible.
So what time would you recommend then, John?
Early in the morning
would
be the best time to harvest salad greens before the heat of the day. You know, later in the day it's cool too, but those plants have accumulated a lot of heat during the day and they're retaining that field heat. So unless you went out, you know, with a flashlight at night, my recommendation would be in the morning. Great way to cool things down quickly is to hydrocool them. big bucket or a tank of your sink filled with really, really cold water, submerge those greens, get that field heat out, rehydrate them a bit, and then keep them in your fridge until it's ready for dinner.
So it sounds like I think a lot of people probably think of going out and picking the greens right before dinner when maybe they're going to have them, but it sounds like that might be the worst time of day to do it. So maybe do it before heading out to work in the morning and then have them ready in the fridge.
That would be my recommendation.
Wow. I like that recommendation. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. And let's go next to Aaron in Waukesha. Hi, Aaron.
Yeah, hey, just a quick question for John. I was curious if you know anything about small-scale growing of red lentils, and if that's possible in Wisconsin.
So growing lentils, that would be
a legume. Yeah, it's kind of more of an agronomic crop as opposed to a vegetable crop when you're talking about growing dried beans. A lot of dry bean production occurs in Minnesota and other parts of the country where they have tend to have drier conditions in the fall because those pods need to dry down, and you can have, you know, if you've got too wet conditions, you can have disease problems. I'm really not familiar with specifically with lentils, but I know that dry beans is not a big commercial crop here in Wisconsin. And, you know, there's reasons for that in terms of how easy it is to do it.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Ann in Hortonville. Hi, Ann.
Hi. We seem to have a problem with acid, and like with tomatoes, has acid in them. Are there some varieties that are either low or have no acid that you can grow?
So you want to avoid the high acid content but still be able to enjoy tomatoes.
Right, right.
Well, my recommendation would be to really pour through the seed catalogs, and you know, a good seed catalog, a good seed company is going to have good descriptions of their products. And I know that I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I know that there are some that are described as being lower in acid.
Well, and I think usually the yellow and the orange tomatoes are a little lower in acid. So
yeah, and you could focus on the sweet cherry tomatoes instead of the full-size tomatoes for that reason.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you.
Sure. But yeah, I think, you know, we were talking about not being sucked in by the appeal of all the great descriptions in a seed catalog, but there is some really good information in there too. And like you said, you know, if it says it's a good shipper, it's going to have probably, it's focusing more on how well it travels than maybe how well it tastes, but you might see things that say lower in acid and things like that. Actually, I think some of the purple and black tomatoes too are lower in acid.
That's probably true.
So great. Well, good luck with that, Anne. And next, let's go right to Joe in Ladysmith. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was wondering if we could grow jicama here in Wisconsin. I know I could get it down in Texas, but I was wondering if we can grow it up here.
And let's describe jicama for the listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Let's have the caller describe jicama.
How would you describe jicama, Joe?
Well, it's almost like a turnip, and it's round, and it's a root crop, and it's great when you cut it in slices, thin slices, and you can eat it just like that or in salads.
It's very starchy and sweet. I almost think of it as a really oversized water chestnut, too. It's got a lot of crunch to it.
A lot of crunch.
An oversized water chestnut. That's probably one of the best descriptions I've ever heard.
There you go. But sweeter, definitely sweeter. And it is very tasty. I mean, and it can be, I can see why it's popular in Tex-Mex and Mexican cuisine, because it's a very refreshing vegetable, I think, for hot climates. But do you know much about growing
it? I know nothing about jicama,
and
so
I'm guessing,
really apologize to the caller.
It feels like it's a more tropical or hot weather.
Right. If it was to be produced here, it would have to be done in a greenhouse or hoop house situation as opposed to in the field, I would assume.
So it looks like, Joe, you're going to have to just buy your jicama and enjoy it when you can.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. And so obviously there are things that we cannot grow here because we have a shorter growing season than, say, Texas or somewhere like Florida. How do you know what your growing season is for where you are? I mean, is it all by what zone you're in that it determines what your how long your growing season actually is?
Yeah, the plant hardiness zones is a good and first resource to go to. The USDA has maps. Actually, they've just been updated recently. And, of course, those zones have changed over the past several decades with trends being towards warmer temperatures. So that's be the first step would be to go to the USDA website for the plant hardiness zone. And you can also go to your county extension office and get average first frost and average last frost. Those are really important figures to know for your location, because a lot of the information you're going to be gathering from either books or seed catalogs is, you know, to start some crop 6 weeks before your last frost, or to plant it, you know, 10 weeks before the first frost. Right. And then, so you need to know when that average first and last frost date are.
And it can be very, especially when we're all getting really itchy about being able to get out in the garden, it's a little too easy to get out there sooner than we should and start planting, start bringing things in the ground.
I think a lot of people get so excited that they plant. One thing that I think happens a lot is people start their tomato plants too early. And most crops, you know, they like to have an uninterrupted, smooth, you know, a nice slope to their growing cycle, as opposed to fits and starts and things being less than ideal. So starting your tomatoes too early and having them get leggy or bound, you know, root bound in the pot is really not a good thing. Mm-hmm. I would rather set out a slightly smaller tomato plant that, you know, didn't have any issues in terms of being pot bound or getting leggy.
Because they'll catch up.
They will catch up.
I have to say, I have to plant all my tomatoes in containers because two of my neighbors have black walnut trees. And it's happened more than once that I have to schlep all the containers inside for a night or two because it dips a little colder than I was expecting it to. But at least with the containers, I can do that.
That's right.
It's not pleasant, but it's not as difficult as if they were in the ground and trying to protect them. So I actually get a little leeway on the getting started too early because I can actually carry them inside and outside. We're talking with John Hendrickson from the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. He has great advice to share about growing vegetables. Do you grow vegetables just for your family or yourself, or do you sell them? And do you have a favorite veggie variety to share? We'd love to hear what works for you and why you enjoy it. And especially if you've participated in the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, we'd love to hear from you and hear what you got out of that experience. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And comments, questions, and photos of your great, delicious veggies on our Facebook page are always welcome, too. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And we had a caller that could not stay on the line, but she said she has leftover seeds from last year, and she's wondering if they're still good or if some might be bad, and how would she tell the difference?
Well, the most foolproof way to find out whether they're still any good is to do a germination test.
Okay.
And the simplest way to do that is to wet the seed, put them in a little plastic bag, maybe with a damp piece of paper towel, and test the germination. You could put 10 or 20 seeds in and then test the germination, you know, 8 out of 10 seeds. That's 80% germination. That's probably something you'd still want to keep hold of and plant in the garden. Generally, seeds, if you're going to hold them from season to season, you want to keep them in a cool, dry place.
And when we say cool, how cool?
Well, some seeds would be fine to keep in the freezer.
Okay.
But the refrigerator is probably a good thing. If you're going to keep in the refrigerator, keep it in an airtight container. And when I say cool and dry, you know, one of the most important things is to not have, you know, temperature fluctuations. Because those temperature fluctuations is going to, you know,
it's giving them signals.
Yeah, it's giving them signals, and they're going to start. And if they start and stop their process too many times, they're going to say, oh, I give up.
And so going back to that germination test, which I think is a great idea. So you would put, say, 20 seeds of a particular variety in a bag with, you wet them, put them in the bag. And then do you leave that, say, on the counter, or, you know, does it need to be in the sun or anything like that?
Yeah, I would just put it on the windowsill.
Okay. And about how long should we wait? Just pay attention to what it says on the
packet. It depends on, yeah.
Oh, Okay. So that's a way that we could do that now to know what seeds we have. Great, because I have a feeling that those seed catalogs are going to be appearing in our mailboxes pretty soon, if not already.
The catalogs for us commercial vegetable growers are out already. I've got several already.
Well, let's go next to Kathy in Clark County. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm so glad to hear this program on the radio. We are beginning market growers. My husband and I live over here on the west side of the state, and our son has a CSA over in the Sheboygan area, and we've been growing crops for his farm, mostly storage things, squash, grew about 9 different varieties of potatoes, and those Hercules carrots are wonderful.
There you go, another Hercules believer.
Good.
But my question is about onions. This year, for the first time, we tried red and white onions, and we put drip lines on, and we grew several thousand for him. And we harvested them and put them in a shed on drying racks, but I think it was probably right at the end of July that we harvested them. And that whole area then, of course, I couldn't plant anything in there, and I spent a lot of time weeding in there. And I'm just wondering what I could put in there. Would there be some kind of a cover crop or something else that we could grow to utilize that space and not have to weed it? It would have to be something, because we have to transport everything over to the other side of the state, it's got to be something that's not real perishable.
So. John?
So something to plant after the onion crop comes out?
Right.
Well, certainly there's cover crop options that you could do to...
And like what would that be?
Well, if you're pulling the onions out in July, which is about the right time, depending on what part of the state you're in terms of when the onion crops is going to be harvested and brought out of the field, you could do any number of things. You could do a round of buckwheat that would grow very quickly, and then you would want to mow that down before the buckwheat went to seed, lest that become a weed problem in the future. And then you could either leave that idle in the fall, or you could plant a cover crop that would overwinter, such as winter rye or wheat.
No,
you could also plant oats and peas in that area as a cover crop.
Okay, now are these cover crops something, because this is not a real huge area and we don't have a lot of equipment, is this something that we could do by hand?
Oh, certainly.
And just broadcast it by hand? Or
you could broadcast it by hand. There's also relatively inexpensive seeders that sometimes they're called spreaders, because they can also spread fertilizer or other materials. Earthway is one brand of cedar spreaders that you can buy. Some of them are quite small. They only holds 2 to 4 cups of seeds. You can also get larger ones that you can do larger areas with. And then if it's a small enough area, you could just simply rake those cover crop seeds in. But there's certainly other things that you could grow with the, you know, if the onion crop comes out early enough, you might be able to get away with a fall crop of those Hercules carrots that we both like. Although you would have to get those started towards the beginning of July in order to get a decent crop of Hercules.
Okay, then the question I have about the cover crops is, since you're planting those in July and judging by this past summer how dry it was, would that require a lot of irrigation and watering, I mean, to germinate? Because that was so dry this year, and a lot of stuff we did put drip lines on just to keep it moist, and that would be too big of an area to water it.
I struggled with that myself this past season to the point where I didn't feel like it made sense to do all of the cover crop planting that I wanted to and that was in my plan, simply because I knew that the seed was just going to sit there.
Right.
In the drought and not germinate. And
be one more thing that would be
struggling. I, like you, did not have a good way to irrigate a large area using drip irrigation for most of my crops. So I faced that same challenge. Ideally, we get a few rains in July and August, and that germination can happen.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. And let's talk a little more about cover crops, because that's actually something that I wanted to bring up. What is the use? Well, we talked about them keeping down weeds, and that's certainly a great thing to take care of. But there are other reasons to plant a cover crop that actually can enhance the soil for whatever your quote unquote real crop is.
That's right. Cover crops are crops that we're planting to improve the soil, to protect the soil, reduce erosion, break up weed and pest cycles. Those are all things that cover crops can do. And, you know, for any window of time and space in your garden, there's usually a cover crop that will fit that window, whether it's early or late season cool crops like oats and peas, things that grow well in the summertime, like the buckwheat that I mentioned. And then there are cover crops that will, you know, grow over the winter. You plant in the fall, they'll start, they'll stay in place and keep the soil in place over the winter and in, you know, through the spring rains, the winter rye and wheats and crops like that. So they're, you know, it's something that many gardeners maybe don't have time and space, or maybe even time and space in their heads to think about. But it is a very, very good practice to engage in, particularly if you're, you know, growing in the same place over and over and over again. If you can, you know, have a quarter of your garden to cover crops and rotate that quarter around through the years, that's something that can really help you and help your garden.
And something like peas would help fix nitrogen
that's
in
correct.
The soil.
All the legume crops will fix nitrogen.
And then the others, say you do the buckwheat, then do you turn that over and so it becomes additional organic matter in the garden?
Yep, incorporating the cover crops adds organic matter.
Great. Something to put on that dream list that everything will get done when it's supposed to be.
That's right.
This year. We're talking with John Hendrickson from the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. He's happy to answer your questions about vegetables, growing them at home or for market use. It's 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Judith Sears Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And John, let's go back to the phones and Judy in Grafton. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I planted a lasagna garden, not this last fall, the one before. I shouldn't say planted, I built it. And it was like 2 feet tall. You know, it was really, I really worked at it. And then in spring I planted and I was expecting this awesome garden and it didn't happen. And I'm just wondering what, I don't know what I did wrong. I'm thinking I may not have had enough of the brown. I might have put more green in. Could that have caused, you know, my carrots never germinated. My beans were fine, but my onions did not grow as big as they usually did. The red beets came up, but not with enthusiasm. I just was really disappointed.
Well, first let's talk about what a lasagna garden is. So we've had Roger Reynolds on and other folks that have done lasagna gardening talk about this. It's basically layering organic and inorganic matter to create, basically you're planting your vegetables directly into compost. I mean, it's a nice way, right, instead of having to dig down to enrich the soil, you're basically building it up. Now, I'm wondering, Judy, if maybe the lack of success you had this year was more because of that drought that so many of us were dealing with. I think a lot of things didn't do as well as people hoped.
I guess it's possible, but I did water. And another thing I'm wondering, I put horse manure. One of the top layers was horse manure. And then I put, I think it was green hay. That was the very top. Was that a mistake? I had heard I could put the manure in there.
So was that composted manure or fresh manure?
It was not real fresh, but it may have, I'm wondering if it was too fresh.
John?
Yeah, that sounds to me like the culprit, in addition to what Judith was saying about the drought. You know, even if you were watering, it still could have been a challenge, especially given that you're essentially building a layered raised bed. And, you know, that's going to dry out very quickly, especially given the conditions that we had this fall, not only the lack of rain, but the, you know, triple-digit wet temperatures that we had, at least in my area. But, yeah, for starters, the use of uncomposted manure is really not recommended because of pathogen issues. You can get yourself or your family or your friends or anybody that eats those vegetables very sick, if not worse than sick. So not recommended for a health and safety issue, but also, you know, that manure is just, it's hot, and it's going to inhibit germination. And the high nitrogen levels are also going to cause problems. Typically, plants that are too high in nitrogen will have put on a lot of vegetative growth. But say in the case of tomatoes, they're not going to produce a lot of fruit. They're just going to keep putting on vegetative growth. So all that nitrogen is not a good plan either.
And so, John, if Judy's problem was the too fresh manure in the lasagna garden last year, will that have aged enough for next year to be a better growing medium?
Well, it certainly will have improved. I guess it would, you know, depend on the exact composition of the materials that she used and the temperature and the water in terms of exactly how much that decomposed and composted. That would be impossible for me to say for sure.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Judy. And let's go next to Jody in Stanley. Hi, Jody.
Hi. I have a question about Brussels sprouts.
All right.
I tried them for the first time this year, growing them, and I didn't put any kind of pesticide on them, and I did find that I had a lot of, when I harvested them, I had to remove an awful lot of layers to get down to where there wasn't any more burrowing, and I'm wondering if there's something that you can safely put on them that's, you know, okay for people.
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to, it sounds like you're trying to avoid the use of, you know, heavy pesticides or things like that.
Yeah.
But something kind of a happy medium between the two.
Right. Yeah. Something I hate to take away the bug's food source. But,
but hopefully they can find some somewhere else. Well, John, what would you.
So was this insect damage or was this a disease?
It was insect.
It was insects. And what did the damage look like?
They were small burrows. Well, I shouldn't say burrows. Holes eaten through.
Lots of little holes, like, you know, like buckshot holes.
Some had quite a few.
It sounds to me like you've got flea beetles. And, of course, Phil Pelletieri's not here today to talk, to expound on flea beetles.
It was a really bad year for flea beetles.
Yeah. There are many different species of flea beetles. And so when I say flea beetles, that's not a very specific diagnosis. But there are a whole host of different flea beetles that just absolutely love the whole cabbage family of crops. And typically the damage looks like, you know, lots of little tiny holes over through a leaf. So that sounds to me like the problem. Flea beetles are really a big hassle to deal with because they're very tiny. They move very fast, very short lifespans and cycles, you know, the multiple cycles through the growing season of these little pests. One thing that you can do is use floating row cover, which is a spun polyester fabric that you can use to put over your plants. It lets both sun and moisture and water through. It does require, if you're going to weed your garden, you're going to have to remove that row cover to do the weeding. And of course, the minute you remove it, the flea beetles can jump in there. One thing that I like to do if I'm covering up an area with row cover, and I do typically will do this with radishes, those being in the same family of crops and being another thing that flea beetles really like, is I will make, my own sticky traps, using, and most species of flea beetles, I guess I can't say all. This is when I'd have to give my friend Phil a call to
Phil
find out for sure.
Phil will be on Wednesday the 9th, actually. So maybe I'll,
many,
if I remember,
many
I'll have
flea
him talk
beetle
about
species
flea beetles.
Are attracted to things that are white. And so they will jump to things that are white. And so I will collect yogurt containers or tofu tubs or whatever have you. You know, many things come in white plastic these days. And I will make traps by coating them with either a commercial product like Tanglefoot, or you can simply use Vaseline to make sticky traps as well. And you can put those in your row or under the row cover around your brassica plants. And it's really quite amazing. The flea beetles will almost immediately start jumping to that white trap. Is it a foolproof method? No, but it certainly can help.
Well, good luck with that, Jody. And we will go next to Frances in Muskego, who is also curious about Brussels sprouts. Hi, Frances.
Hi. My problem with the Brussels sprouts is different. My Brussels sprouts grow, and a lot of them are real nice on the outside, but when I cut them open and stuff, there's like little black marks. Some of the leaves are black, and I, by the time I try to save, you know, what left, I get nothing because it's inside of it. And some of them even have it on the outside, but the majority of them, it's on the inside.
Yeah, there's a number of diseases that affect the cabbage family and Brussels sprouts. There's black rot and black leg and alternaria. And the unfortunate thing about many of those diseases is that they're seed-borne. And so you may actually be getting the disease with the seed that you're buying. So I would make sure to buy from a reputable company that tests their seed. Catalog I happen to be looking at right now is Johnny's Selected Seed Catalog, one of my favorite seed companies. And they test their seed, and it's certified as being tested and free of those diseases. So that would be the place to start.
So in a situation like that for Frances, there's nothing... It's not that she was doing something wrong once it was in the ground. It was the actual putting it in the ground that probably started it all.
I can't say for sure, yeah. But those diseases are spread via seed-borne pathogens.
We are talking with John Hendrickson from the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. He has great advice about growing wonderful vegetables for home or for selling. And we'd love to have you join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about growing great garden veggies with John Hendrickson, and he is the coordinator of the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. And John, there was a nice comment on Facebook from Stephen. He says he took the Beginning Market Growers course a couple of years ago. Excellent resource for those interested in growing for the market. And so why don't we take that opportunity to talk a little more about the School for Beginning Market Growers. There is a link on our Facebook page to an article that talks about the School for Beginning Market Growers, how to register, and information about what is covered. And it's coming up. It's January 18th to the 20th.
That's right. It's coming up quick. And I should note that I've entered the modern era, and we now have a Facebook page for the grower schools. I kind of came into this kicking and screaming, but we do have a Facebook page, and so I'm sure we can probably get that linked from Larry's
mm-hmm. Sure,
site.
We'll absolutely do that, yeah.
That would be great.
So what kind of topics are covered in the Beginning Market Growers
School?
Well,
we really feel it's important to present new and beginning growers with kind of the full gamut of information, skills, and fortitude required to start growing vegetables as a business. So we try to cover everything. We actually launch the school by talking about marketing. When we first started the school, we felt like we needed to go from the ground up. So mm-hmm. we started talking about soils and soil fertility first, and then proceeded our way through to marketing at the end. But so many decisions, if you're going to grow vegetables and sell them, so many decisions you make are based on how you're going to sell them mm-hmm. and where you're going to sell them. So we start
there.
And
what kind of market there is for what you're going to
sell. Exactly. So that's where we start. We start with the marketing, and we talk then we go through the whole gamut of things that people need to know about, kind of the economic landscape of doing this as a business. How much can you expect to earn growing vegetables and selling them at a farmer's market mm-hmm. or doing a CSA, such as the caller earlier was talking about? And then we talk about all the practical stuff, the tools and resources and the greenhouses and the irrigation and all that stuff that mm-hmm. you need to know, managing labor.
So you really, I mean, it's not just about the growing.
No,
you
it's
really
not just about
everything.
The growing. You know, it's really actually, you know, we kind of assume that if someone's serious about doing this as a business, they're coming with a certain
That's
amount
a good
of
point.
Knowledge about mm-hmm. the growing part, but they need help with how to make this into a business part.
And for people that are thinking about getting started growing for sale at a market, or like you said, a CSA, which is a community supported agriculture share where people basically pay up front and then get a weekly delivery. So mm-hmm. they're supporting the farm. Or you were saying that you sell
to restaurants.
Mm-hmm. How does someone decide if they have if they can make it work? If they can do it on a scale that makes sense. I mean, obviously, not everyone with a little backyard garden could or should think about that. But how does someone decide that they can grow enough to be able to actually market it?
Well, that's a pretty complicated process and involves a number of steps. One really good step is taking the School for Beginning Market Growers so that you can hear from three experienced growers, in addition to myself and some of our university specialists here on campus, about what it takes and how much you can grow mm-hmm. per acre and how much you're liable to earn per acre. And so that's kind of mm-hmm. one bare bones fact is how much you can
doing
produce
math,
in a given space.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to look at your local markets and do some research, find out what the prices are for various crops at the farmer's market, or how much the grocery store pays, a wholesale price from local farms mm-hmm. for products.
And about how many farmers or potential growers go through the program every year?
We usually have between 30 and 50 people. The most we ever had was 65 or 70.
From all over the state?
All over the state and our neighboring states.
Oh, great. And there is a cost associated, but as an investment in a potential enterprise,
yes.
it's pretty reasonable.
The class is $325 for the 3 days, and that includes a big three-ring binder full of resources, as well as the book, Sustainable Vegetable Production from Startup to Market. Three meals a day and three concentrated days with experienced growers mm-hmm. That you get to kind of get to know the ins and outs of their operation.
And do you find that the growers that go through it kind of, form a network to support each other?
Yes, there's a lot of networking that goes on, a lot of sharing, not just from the instructors to the participants, but among the participants mm-hmm. and participants to the instructors as well.
And are there resources?
And another thing I'd say about the cost is that I kind of feel like it's much better to spend 3 days and $300 to figure out whether this is going to work for you than 3 years and who knows how much
that's
money invested.
That's a great way to look at it. And are there resources for non-native English speakers who are growers? Because it certainly seems like there are a lot of Hmong growers and Latino growers in Wisconsin too.
We are looking into providing specific programming for those populations, and I my bias is that typically those people, not only is there the language issue that needs to be dealt with, but typically those people may need different kinds and different levels of information than a different mm-hmm. Typical standard audience.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those people are coming from countries where they did a lot of food production, and so they know how to grow the food.
Right.
But maybe they need some help on, reading the label on the pesticide label, or understanding how Americans deal with shopping and pricing,
cultural
and that
issues.
The cultural mm-hmm. issues. A lot of other cultures have, it's a dickering process at the farmer's market, whereas in America that's really not part of the game.
Right.
So we feel strongly that we need to put together specific programs for a lot of those populations rather than just kind of stick them into our program mm-hmm. that we've developed.
That's the School for Beginning, Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. And again, there is a link on our website, on our Facebook page. And the address for that information is www.cias.wisc.edu. So you can find information there. And we'll mention that again later in the show as well. Let's go back to the phones, John, and talk with Kelly in Green Bay. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. My husband and I do a lot of gardening and a lot of canning, but in the wintertime, we really miss our fresh produce. And I'm wondering, other than like sprouts or microgreens, what we can grow indoors in the wintertime, and maybe without artificial light because the energy cost gets kind of expensive.
All right. So Kelly would like to have year-round fresh veggies.
Well,
I don't think she's alone.
No, wouldn't we all? Unless you're willing to put in some resources in terms of providing adequate heat and light in terms of the day length that vegetables need to grow, you're really limited in terms of what you can do in the wintertime in terms of vegetable production. You mentioned the microgreens and sprouts. In addition to that, you can certainly grow some basil, maybe some other herbs, maybe some herbs that you were outside and you just brought inside mm-hmm. For the winter, rosemary, things like that. But vegetables need a certain intensity of light and a duration of light. And so unless you're willing to have, maybe an add-on greenhouse onto your house and provide some of that artificial lighting, you're really limited in terms of what you can produce in a house. I mean, there are certainly lots of growers that are doing amazing things with, field tunnels and hoop houses and growing things through the winter, spinach, many different types of the brassica greens, scallions, even carrots and things like that.
Well, and I know some people use cold frames, so basically creating a small-scale greenhouse or hothouse to maybe the way to look at it is how can you continue some of the crops that are out there instead of trying to bring them inside. But I know people who, especially when we had that really mild winter, that were still harvesting spinach from a cold frame into January.
Oh, yeah. And you can continue to do those harvests. The thing to remember is that you're essentially substituting, a cooler or a freezer for the field production, because the spinach is not going to be doing a tremendous amount of growing during that time. You need to plant it early enough in the fall so that it has it's of decent size and decent root structure to make it through the winter, and it'll grow some, particularly if we're blessed with some sunny days through the winter. But you're mainly using it as essentially another type of cold storage,
right?
And it's whether you want to go to your refrigerator and pull something out, or whether you want to go outside in the snow and pull something out.
Talking with John Hendrickson from the Wisconsin School of Beginning Market Growers. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, you start out a new growing season full of hope and anticipation, and sometimes the garden lives up to our expectations, while other times, well, let's just say that we spend more time trying to figure out where we went wrong than enjoying the bounty of our garden. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Hendrickson is with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, and he's the coordinator of the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. He has great advice for anyone who's trying to grow the best veggies they can. John, thanks again for coming by to visit with us.
Thank you very much.
And it's we've been having a lot of fun talking about growing veggies, and like we said, hope springs eternal, right? It's like they kind of say that with childbirth, right? You forget all the pain and you think of all the wonderful things. I think gardening's kind of like that. You think, oh, next year I'm going to have learned everything there is, and no bugs and no diseases. And
yeah, in general, yes. I'd say for me, I'm still a little bit recovering from this past growing season, given how challenging it was with the heat and the drought.
Well, but, and what were you hearing from your market growers?
Well, it was different from different parts of the state, but virtually everyone experienced one of the more challenging seasons that we've had. I can't remember the exact dates, but I know that there was at least 6 or 8 weeks that we had, not a drop of rain on my farm. And then, to make matters worse, we had the triple digit temperatures where I suddenly felt like I was living in
like
Phoenix,
slime,
Arizona.
Yeah.
And when it's that hot, the plants even need more water because they need to try to keep cool by doing their evapotranspiration. And then, there just wasn't that water. And so, plants, we lost a few crops on our farm. But, in general, a drought is a bit easier to deal with than a flood, which we've had a couple of those in recent history. It's, if you have an irrigation system, you can get water to crops. It's not really possible to suck water out of the fields. Mm-hmm. So, there were some things, we had less disease this year because of the dry conditions.
Right. And folks up in, say, the Superior area dealt with both because they they had those torrential rains in June, I believe. And then like the rest of the state, they also had the drought conditions.
Yeah, just
later.
As we were starting our drought, they had more water than they needed.
Wow. Well, let's go back to the phones and talk first with Ron in Sauk City. Hi, Ron.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I had a challenging year last year, of course, and I appreciate your comments just now. My question involves soil preparation. I was in the military for many, many years and kind of grew things wherever I could dig up some dirt and used a lot of fertilizer. And I came upon this garden plot that I'm using now, about 2,000 square feet, 6 years ago, about the same time my granddaughter was born. And decided that I didn't want to use chemical fertilizers anymore. And so I started enriching my soil with, I've got a great source of sheep compost, composted sheep manure. Mm. And I put on maybe 1,200 pounds in the spring every year and work it into the soil. And it's beautiful compost. I've I can't complain about that a bit. But I'm just wondering, am I doing the right thing? I'm working it down about 4 or 5 inches every year, whatever a garden variety tiller will take. You know, I don't plow it. Mm-hmm. I just work up the top of the dirt. It was sandy loam when I started. I mean, heavy on the sandy side. And it still, when we get a rain, I can walk out into the garden and not get a lot of mud on my shoes because it works the sand up right away anytime we get a good heavy rain, mm-hmm. which, of course, didn't happen last year. But is that the thing to do? I had my soil tested 3 years ago, and it was nearly perfect. That was the first year I put on the sheep manure.
So basically, Ron is working the manure down about 4 or 5 inches. He's putting it on a couple times a year. Does that sound like a good plan?
Well, it's really not possible to make specific recommendations without doing a soil test. So I would really encourage you to, rather than just kind of do the same thing every year, to take a soil test. Might not need to do that every year. It's not a bad idea to do it every year, but at least every 2 or 3 years, do a soil test. And the soil test will help determine whether you need to add more of that wonderful sheep compost. I'd love to have some of that if you want to share. It sounds like you've got a great resource, and it's certainly a wonderful product to add to the garden. But I wouldn't just add it as a matter of course. I would add it based on what a soil test is telling you your soil mm-hmm. needs.
Because he could get to the point where it's too much of a good thing.
Yeah, you certainly could get to a point, especially with phosphorus and potassium, phosphorus especially, with manure-based composts. And if it's a Wisconsin, I don't know if this is a garden plot or if it was farmland, but chances are most Wisconsin soils are heavy in phosphorus because of mm-hmm. the nature of the soil plus the nature of our agriculture industry here with the dairy business. Mm-hmm. So we often have excessive phosphorus in soil. So I'd just be careful about that and do a soil test and make sure you're not overdoing it.
And that's good advice for Ron, but for the rest of us too, to get our soil tested. How does one do that if people have never done that before? Where do they start?
Well, the University of Wisconsin has a soil testing service. You can contact your either go directly to the soil testing lab, which you can find easily online, or go to your local county extension agent mm-hmm. and have them help you out. I believe every county extension office is going to be able to provide you with the little bags that the soil testing service likes to get their samples in, although it's not required to be in that bag. The extension agent can also help you with methods for taking that soil test and even provide you with tools to do that soil test.
Great. So that's UW Extension and then looking at your county and for the horticulture agent. Thanks for that, Ron. And let's go to Stephen in Richland County next. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Judith and John.
Hi.
John said something that you could save seeds by putting them in the freezer. Is there a resource that I could use to find out which seed you could safely store in a freezer and then reuse them?
So basically, is there a way to know which seeds you can keep?
Well, one of the best books that I know about seed saving, and I'm going to blank on the title and the author right now. I'm having one of those mental lapses that happens as you get older. Maybe another, I'm sure many of our listeners are probably thinking of the same book than I am. And maybe during the break we can do a Google search here for a resource. But I'm not sure if it's in print anymore, but it's a very common book, probably very easy to find in your local library.
And I wonder if Seed Savers, the organization, might have.
That's another excellent resource.
So I believe that Seed Savers. Is it .com, .org? I'll ask Rhonda, our producer, to check that, and we can get that up. But I know that there are some good resources out there about seed saving, and especially people that are interested in those heirloom varieties like Seed Savers, the organization, they probably have some good information. So we'll ask Rhonda Fanning, our on-air producer, to look at that. So it looks like she found Seed to Seed saving and growing techniques for vegetable gardeners by Suzanne Ashworth And Kent Wheely, does that sound familiar?
Well, those are well-known names. Kent Wheely is who started Seed Savers.
Oh, well, there you go. So there's a book called Seed to Seed, Seed Saving and Growing Techniques for Vegetable Gardeners. Rhonda just found that very efficiently. Thanks for that. And Seed Savers is a great organization. It's in Iowa, I believe.
Yeah, not far away. They have a great summer festival that you can attend.
There you go. So check out Seed Savers. And let's move next to Matilda in Baldwin. Hi, Matilda.
Hello.
Yes.
A while ago, you were talking about growing lima beans, or somebody was asking you about them. And I used to grow lima beans, and I did it successfully, so I could tell you how I did it.
So what were your secrets?
I live up here on the northern edge of Pierce County, so we're not in a very warm climate, and it's lima beans do require a long growing season. So I didn't get lima beans every year, but I love them so much, so I would keep planting them. And maybe 2 out of 3 years I'd get lima beans. The other year I wouldn't. So
it is possible.
It is possible. It's not like a guaranteed vegetable because it's very dependent on the weather.
So it's one of those that maybe we plant and hope for the best, but know that they just might not work that year.
Yes, and the thing is they don't like cold soil, so you can't start planting them until about the 1st of June here. And then they're ready to, if you have a warm summer, they'll be ready to eat maybe the end of August and mostly in September.
Okay, well, great. Thanks so much for sharing that. I love how our listeners take care of each other by sharing information.
And that's one of the reasons why I was suggesting that the person may want to try transplanting them because of that, the fact
right.
that you can't plant them until the soil warms up. So you could get a jump on the season by starting as a transplant.
And it does say, some vegetables do say on the seed packets that, you know, they're not good for transplant to really try to direct seed. Why is that? Why do some tolerate that better than others?
Well, you know, just like people are different. Different plants are different and have different likes and dislikes. Yeah, there are certain crops that just do not like to have their roots disturbed when they're young and growing.
So as tempting as it is,
right?
Really
cilantro is one that doesn't really like to be transplanted. Dill is one that really, really hates to be transplanted. Mm. The cucumbers, melons, and squash, you can get away with transplanting those, but they really would prefer to be direct seeded
okay.
and not be disturbed.
So those are ones we just have to sit on our hands and wait until it's good and warm out.
Yep.
It is always tempting to put things in the ground earlier than maybe they would like to be. But the thing that someone said at some point that has stuck with me is some plants just like don't like to have cold feet.
That's
and
right.
So I try to remind myself, don't make them have cold feet if they don't want to, because they're not going to cooperate anyway. Rhonda also found that link to Seed Savers. So it's www.seedsavers.org, and they are in Decorah, Iowa. So
yep.
not too far for a lot of us in Wisconsin.
And the book that I was trying to rack my brain for was the New Seed Starters Handbook by Nancy. I'm not sure how she pronounces her last name. It's B-U-B-E-L. Bubel.
Right.
I'm not sure which pronunciation is correct. It's specifically about starting seeds, but there's good information in there about storing seeds and saving seeds as well.
All right. And thanks again, Matilda, for that information on the lima beans. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We do have some open lines and a little bit more time with John Hendrickson talking about growing great vegetables. And Frank in Cedarburg is next. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Good morning, sir and ma'am. Have a question. I grew some fennels this past year from plants, and I'd like to know when can I start the seed.
So this is to grow the fennel bulb.
The fennel bulb, yes.
Okay.
And I'm used to growing seed for my onion plants, but I'd like to know just what do you do with the fennel seed.
All right.
And when?
And fennel bulbs are something that are not that common in American cuisine, but they have a really, you can cook them. Do you usually cook them or eat them raw, Frank?
My wife cuts them apart for eating raw.
Okay, yeah. They have a very nice light anise flavor to them.
Yes, it is.
And I also, I'm actually talking a little bit so John can look at his seed catalog, but also the little stalks that kind of come up that almost look like celery have a really nice anise flavor that you can put into salad too. So John, when could Frank maybe start his seeds for seeds for fennel bulbs, that's a tongue twister, indoors to get a jump start on the growing season?
Well, fennel is one that I don't grow. I actually don't. My palate doesn't like that.
It took me a while,
that licorice
actually.
Anise taste. So it's not one that's in my wheelhouse. So I don't grow that on my farm. I do know a lot of growers that grow it in succession and harvest the bulbs at a relatively small size, kind of baby fennel mm-hmm. heads. They're very, you know, nice and tender and wonderful if you like that flavor. So I would actually suggest doing a succession planting of them so that you have it throughout the growing season.
Mm-hmm. And about how long a growing time is it for the fennel?
Well, for a full-size head, 70 to 80 days. So that's quite long, mm-hmm. Which is another reason why it might be nice to just harvest them as babies and do multiple successions mm-hmm. rather than have to wait all season long and then harvest them all at once. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, good luck with that, Frank. And there was a note on the Facebook page from Gary who said the Beginning Market Growers program was very helpful for establishing our farm's market business. And he provided a link to their farm, which is Prairie View Farm in the Mount Calvary area of rural Wisconsin. So another positive review of the Beginning Market Growers program, which, again, you can get more information about that by going to, let me grab the link here, www.cias.wisc.edu. And also, Aaron on Facebook said, I grew some snap peas in my garden last year, and they seemed to do great, and the plants grew tall and healthy, but did not produce any pods, and then the plants just dried up and died. I watered every day, twice a day sometimes. Was it just bad luck, or could it have been something else? My onions just didn't grow either, but my tomatoes and peppers did great.
Well, I'm wondering if what time of the year the peas were growing. Peas are a cool season crop, and if she was trying to grow them during the heat of the of the summer and the drought, that may have been her problem.
Mm-hmm. So peas should be early spring or early fall.
Well, you know, they're typically just grown in the spring, and you know, June, the early June farmers market is when you know all those mounds of peas for sale at your local farmers market. There are a growing number of people who are trying to do a fall crop. It's a little bit tricky because mm-hmm. the peas don't like hot weather, and in order to get the fall crop, you're going to have
to
planting into that in that warm season, and the pea diseases, powdery mildew and stuff, can be a real problem in the heat of the summer.
We have another pea question. Anna in Oconto County is on the line. Hi, Anna.
Hi, this is in regard to growing long-term vegetables successfully. I have had success with just about all of the late growers with using extra-large peat pots to begin with, and then covering the bottoms of them with newspaper so the bottom doesn't start falling apart before it's time to put it in the ground. And I didn't lose any of them. I've had cucumbers and squash and on just a number of things. And in regard to fennel, I take the fennel in I plant it first in a large planter, and then I take it in from the patio in the fall and keep it through the winter, keep it cut way down and just barely enough water to keep it going. And in the spring, it just booms right up again. No problem with that at all, and it will come to its maturity that way.
So you're keeping the fennel going indoors? Is this a potted?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In the patio pots, if they're in a large enough pot, I can. Well, let's say the pot's like 18 inches across. I generally put a 6 to 8 fennel plants in that pot, and I don't lose a one of them. I put them all. In fact, I got one going upstairs now that it's its third year.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like Anna has...
Well, there you go. There was an answer for our previous caller who wanted to produce some vegetables inside. I had no idea that that was possible with fennel.
There you go. You can do a big pot of fennel. Thanks so much for that, Anna. And David, caller David, wondered about tips for weed suppression when growing pumpkins.
Well, of course, the best advice, and really the only true advice, is that it's persistence.
And just really staying on top of it.
Right. Now that said, I don't mean to be flippant and contrite, but you do need to stay after it and be persistent. There are tools that are fairly effective. Is this a caller or someone that wrote in?
It was someone that wrote in.
Okay. Well, I guess so. I'm not sure if they're a gardener or a farmer. If they're a farmer, there are tools, weed control tools, that are quite well suited to vine crop production. A springtime cultivator, which is basically a big rake with lots of tines, you can go right over, mm-hmm. right over the pumpkin plants, especially when they're small and before they've vined out, to keep the weeds down in the early part of the season. After they've vined out, if you're not going to use pesticides, there's not really a good way to get in there with any mm-hmm. kind of tractor or right. cultivating tool. So it's hand pulling after the things have vined out. Certainly a lot, great solution is to use mulch, plastic mulch in the row. And then between the rows of plastic mulch, you can use hay or straw.
Great. And let's go to Jose in Sheboygan next. Hi, Jose.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I want to ask you if you're familiar with that fertilizer, organic fertilizer, Milogranate. Is that something that we purchase here? I believe it's produced in Milwaukee from the sewer system, something like that.
So Milogranate?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, Milogranate is a product out of Milwaukee that's made from the municipal sewage treatment. I would not recommend using that in a fertilizer. It's not allowed if you're a certified organic producer. Mm. And, whether you're certified organic or not, I think some of the guidelines and regulations are kind of good things to follow, no matter what kind of a gardener you might be.
Well, just this as a house gardener, I do plant tomatoes. I use that in tomatoes, and they do produce well with that,
Mm-hmm.
So, but my question is that safe to use? Is something that, now you mentioned is not for organic gardening, is not recommended?
Well, if you're a certified organic commercial producer, you're not allowed to use it.
Because it's considered a chemical.
It's considered a prohibited substance in terms of the national organic rule.
Oh, is that right? So that means it's not good to use for something that...
Well, it doesn't mean it's not good to use. It means that it's not allowed if you're certified organic. It's basically a personal choice as to whether you feel that is a product that you want to use in your garden to produce vegetables for you and your family.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jose. And in just a few seconds we have left, I want to make sure people know, John, where to find information about the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, which is coming up January 18th to 20th. And the website is www.cias.wisc.edu. Is there anything else people need to know to sign up?
If they want to call me directly about the program, they can call me at 608-265-3704.
John Hendrickson from the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Judith. Pleasure.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening.